How can you do first steps towards climate adaptation? That's what we chatted about with Lucy Stewart in an interview for my next book on how to create services that serve both humans and planet. Lucy is a design researcher for climate adaptation, a community organizer, and an urban food grower. She helps organizations to collaboratively identify, define, build, and test ideas that confront the climate crisis and enable a just transition. Lucy is also an educator at the School of Good Services, where together with Ness Wright, she leads the course Designing Sustainable Services. From this conversation with Lucy, I saw 10 early service design principles that can help you adapt your service to the climate crisis. Here are my 5 favorite ones. Number 1, be clear that shit will hit the fan. Accept that every part of life has always changed and will continue to always change. Learn to work with the change. Number 2, don't leave people behind. Make sure that even when you adapt your service to work in tough times, that it doesn't make it harder for people who are in vulnerable or marginalized groups to access your services. Number 3, map inputs and outputs. Discover that your intangible service is in fact very material by looking at all the things that you need to wrap it. Number 4, don't just learn the tools, use the tools. Don't get lost in exploring and finding the latest and greatest sustainability tools. Choose one or two, use them, see if they work, and adjust. And number 5, make your workspace and surroundings friendly for things smaller than humans, bees, birds, and other creatures. And remember, kids are also small creatures. Thanks so much to Lucy for this lovely conversation. Hello, Lucy.
Yes.
It's such a pleasure to finally see you.
I think, like we've said, we've been following each other for a while. So it's nice to, we're not quite in person, but it's nice to see you and see your face and get to know you a little bit better. So thank you very much for inviting me.
And it's such a pleasure because I'm one of these people in the silent majority of people who follow your work, maybe without shouting, "This is great," and so on every time. That's always, there is always some interesting bits that I could steal from you in a very discreet way. And I hope that today I can give a bit more light to one of the people that I've stolen for a bit of time.
Well, at least my understanding of design and service design and the work that we do is that unless somebody's using it, what's the point? So that's like music to my ears. And hopefully there will be, I hope to provide some more nuggets that others can steal. Speaking with no level of expertise, but just with exploration. So it's always really lovely to be given these opportunities to chat about our work and what we're trying to do with it, because sometimes it can feel abstract. And so this is a very refreshing conversation.
And that brings me to this first question, which is, when you go to a birthday party and you have to explain to strangers that don't know anything about your field what you're doing in life, what keeps you busy, how do you present yourself?
That's such a difficult question, I think, isn't it? Because I think what I try and do immediately and what I found has worked is, you know, when I say I'm a designer and people are like, oh, you know, what type of design is that? And I'm, you know, and I futz around a little bit and I'm like, oh, it's, but I say immediately, like, how did you get here? How did you get to this birthday party? And they would say, you know, maybe a bus or a train or a drone. And I say, you know, all of that is designed, whether that be where you hang your keys in order to pick it up to get in the car, or, and it's conscious decisions around how all of that is orchestrated, how easy it is for you to pay using your tap and go card. And I find at a party, I don't say what I do, but I try and introduce and get to know people through, I guess, kind of understanding their lives within service context. And so I think my introductions are, they're pretty futzy and they're pretty long-winded. And sometimes eyes really light up and sometimes they totally glaze over. But I think I try and not introduce myself by way of my work. You know, I talk about myself as I would like to be understood beyond what I do for a living, which is, you know, somebody who loves swimming and gardening and, you know, what this is the last book I read. And but by way of communicating that natural question that always comes up, which is what do you do? I try and put it back to the people when, and then I find as soon as people kind of can orientate themselves of like, okay, transport is a service, then I can go into what I actually do, which is work across all different digital, non-digital. People have to navigate the world, but increasingly I'm interested in what climate change will do for how we have to adapt, how we navigate the world. And that includes how we do it individually and how we do it within the services that we have built around us in order to survive, rightly or wrongly, right? So it's hard to introduce myself at a party because I am multitudes and I want to get that across to people. And our work is sometimes not, it's not, it'd be, I've, my poor parents have said to my mom, just lie to people, tell them I'm a lawyer. Like it's too, but we all have stories related to how we navigate the world. And if I can help people see that, then talking about the fact that currently I'm designing a service to help people understand and information about air quality to protect their health, then it's something that they can kind of get around. So my introductions at parties are a bit awkward. I'm not, you know, it takes a couple of rounds for me to make friends, but then, yeah, then it's a good party. So
lovely. I really appreciate this aspect of showing to or acting in the way that we say the job title doesn't define the person. It's one part of the day. And for many people, there is many more hours in the day. Yeah. And I've been in that same situation where often people ask me, what do I do? And these days, the answer that I give is always, so mostly I'm a dad. And because that's the thing that takes most of my hours. But maybe you wanted to ask, what do I do when I'm paid? And for the paid thing, that's the thing that I do to get paid to then have time with my son. And so that's like a strange thing. Then especially these days where people are like freaking out, oh, you're a man and you're taking care of your son. That's weird. At least in conservative, sometimes in conservative aspect. But I like this kind of positive provocation of not saying, hello, I'm job title, but hello, these are passions that are around.
Yeah, and I think
that's quite a beautiful way.
My association with people in our world is that, you know, it's not a clear boundary between work and life either. And I've struggled with working in this area personally because it feels sometimes not very tangible and, you know, layered underneath systems that unless you're in them, they're hard to see. So yeah, I fell into this work much by accident, and it's been a very interesting, windy path. And I think there's an element sometimes of being a little subconscious isn't the right word, but like you know, I think we all came into this profession wanting to do good in the world, right? And feeling like through our practice we could support people in navigating systems that they are required to do so because they have a disability or they're simply trying to get healthcare for their child. And sometimes, yeah, it's just so hard when you're in it to feel like you are doing that. And I think for me, it's this tiptoeing around this. Because once people get what you do, it's like, oh, cool. And I'm like, yeah, it is cool. I'm really lucky. I get to poke my nose in things that I never would have been able to do in another profession. And, you know, I get to be indulgent about, do I work in-house? Do I freelance? Do I work in a design studio? So it's, you know, like, I'm probably speaking a bit more candidly with you now because I'm going through a period of being like, what am I doing and where am I? But I think that constant questioning is a part of what we do. But of course, that makes it quite difficult to then just succinctly introduce yourself when all of those lines are so blurred. So, but yeah, I think if we introduce our whole selves, then the work quickly makes sense in terms of that. Yeah.
And so.
I read a beautiful book called, not at all to do with service design or anything, but it's a piece of fiction by Barbara Kingsolver, who's an American author, very well known, and she wrote a beautiful book called Damon Copperhead, which was her modern version of the Charles Dickens book about children in poverty. And this was a book about a beautiful character who grew up very rough in Appalachia, so a very poor stretch of America. I was born and raised in America. This obviously has, and I think it was very good to read in the context of politics in America at the moment. And it was just a beautiful narrative around the experience of this young boy, his character, his relationships, and how he navigates growing up in poverty and dealing with drug addiction, which is, you know, really powerful in this part of America. Like, it's devastated communities. And so I finished that book a few weeks ago. And, you know, I guess in some ways it is relevant to work because it's about systems that fail people. But I loved it. It was, took me a while to get into it. But once I did, I was like very attached to this character. And I know it's a good book when I feel that way. So recommend.
Oh, that's lovely. So people have already an element to add in their wish list for reading. That's already one. That's very good. That's very good. And I'm curious, often from how I perceive you, you have this expertise in this notion of climate adaptation. Like, how do we adapt to the new reality, to the new systems, to what is happening at the moment? And how would you describe what that is? Because it sounds like one of those complex words. What is this climate adaptation thing? And how is that also relevant to people who say, I'm the owner of a little shop, or I'm a dentist, or I'm just someone doing some coaching or therapy? How does that big idea relate?
I think where I'll start with it is that somebody who works very high up in climate worlds goes to all of the COPs, which are the big global summits around climate change. And he said to me, Lucy, climate adaptation, as I talk about it, is everywhere. If maybe somebody grew up by a pond in, I don't know, Scotland, say, or Switzerland, and all of a sudden, you know, they have vivid childhood memories of skating on this pond during winter. But as they're growing older and they go back maybe to see their parents or something, the pond isn't freezing over in the way that they can experience it, like they have memories of experiencing it. And I read this paper about narrative change around climate and the stories that we tell to get people to realize that the environment in which we are working, whether you be a dentist or a shop owner or a therapist, is, and whether it's changing because of something you believe in, which is climate change, or for other reasons, change is inevitable. And this has been a really big theme in my work, is that change has always happened and will continue to do so. How we navigate that is the question. And so when I talk about climate change in the context of services or owning and operating a building, it's about acknowledging that whether it be a freak storm or less frost or heavy rainfall, that how we operate is going to be stressed more. It's already stressed more than it was 10 years ago, and it's going to be further stressed in another 10 years from now. And I think unless we start thinking about that, whether we're designing a digital service or thinking about how our patients get from where they are to my dentist seat, then we without starting to think about that, I think we risk business continuity. You maybe can't open your shop for a week. Like, that's pretty devastating for a small shopper, you know? Maybe you have a drop in patients because the road to your dentistry practice floods frequently and people can't get to you. Maybe you have an increase of patients coming in as a therapist that have climate anxiety, because we know this is happening, right? And all of a sudden you're confronted in helping somebody navigate something that is totally unpredictable over the long term and intangible. And that's why describing climate adaptation is difficult because it's so much about now. But what I also like about it is that it trains me, starts to think about the future. And I think so much of my early practice in service design was like delivered to this 3-month brief. Like, but actually climate forces me to think over the next 1 year, 2 year, 5 year, 10. And so I think when I talk about adaptation, I wish there was a better way to describe it, but it really, I think it's more less on the climate, more on the adaptation, which is like, we all need to find more ways to live. Because even if our consumption patterns weren't contributing to a warming world, they would be using resources. And those resources are finite. So whichever way you start to square the narrative is that like, we have to kind of change the way that we do things. And I think change is scary for people. And I think a lot of the stuff that I'm trying to, I'm not trained in, climate adaptation is a huge academic discipline. It's about modeling and finance, and risk is a big one. And, you know, a lot of people spend lots and lots of time, but I don't have a degree in adaptation. And it's something I've morphed into through the different pieces of work that I've done. But the way I think about it is that any service or any business operation, first and foremost, runs on stuff, like what we call the inputs, and creates stuff as a result of operating outputs. So adaptation, I think, is both about recognizing your role in change and what you're consuming and why and what that means for a user's experience, but then also recognizing the impacts of this change are already affecting your ability to deliver what you do. And that helps me think about what perspective I'm going to come to a problem with. But really it's about, you know, I think in scientific circles, we talk about mitigation, adaptation, and resilience. So mitigation is like reducing our outputs. Like, we got to get carbon off the table very quickly. And we also need to think a lot more about our water resources. Adaptation is, change is inevitable. We know that it's baked in. Even if we were to stop using petrol cars flying tomorrow, we are projected for climatic change of 1.5, probably 2 degrees now. So we're going to have to adapt. Like, storms are going to get worse. These events that we're seeing more and more on our screens are going to become more frequent. And then resilience is about how we equipped ourselves socially, financially to deal with that change that we're seeing. And I think service design or business operations, you can slot into those things. You know, there are companies that exist to deliver services that help to reduce carbon emissions, or retrofit homes. This is a big thing at the moment in the UK. But the adaptation and resilience stuff is, I'm seeing way more of that now. And arguably people have been studying this for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. But in terms of services, I mean, it depends on where you look. In like UK's NHS, they're doing some amazing work thinking about like the impact of these operations on hospitals and ability to run. I think it is relevant to all of us. And whether you're a service owner in government or in a charity or running a small business, I think it's a worthwhile practice. And I say practice because it's hard to think long-term. And it's hard to think in the abstract around weather. And it's also hard if you're just struggling to put food on the table for your family, right? And this is where I think services design becomes interesting, because of the co-benefits. You know, if you are more sustainable, sometimes there is a financial benefit. Your costs are reduced. And I'm trying to explore these co-benefits in my work as well. But it's all quite hard, especially like in places where I'm working at the moment, because it's not necessarily what people are asking for. And there's a little bit of me that worries that we're still a little bit, we need to meet our financial target this year focused, while missing all of the stuff that's happening kind of in the background that will mean those targets will become kind of redundant in the future. So that was a bit of a long-winded answer, but hopefully ties to those audiences that you introduce. Like, I really think goes back to my original point, is that adaptation is everywhere and we all need to be doing it. And I can, yeah, refine that too. We all need to become better versed in navigating change. And I think that has a very strong service and business perspective to it.
It reminds me how in some countries, people, when they explain what service design is, they use the word risk management, where they say, basically, it's about reducing the risk that if things go to shit, that we still can do the important things that we want to do. And from what I hear of what you're saying, things will go to shit. We are all clear on that. If you believe in it or in climate change or not, we all see that there will be issues. And there will be more. And I think it's quite an interesting way to... I like how you frame adaptation, and not just as climate adaptation, but adaptation in general. So if we build that muscle of thinking about the future of what could go to shit, then suddenly we're better at making the service also today. Things can go to shit just for people, but things can go to shit also just basically in the weather and so on. So that's quite a beautiful way. And I'm curious, so if someone says, oh, this adaptation thing, that's quite powerful. I need to build that muscle, that practice, as you said. But where do I start?
I think it's a question that I get a lot. So that's why we developed this sustainable service design training through the School of Good Services. And there's a couple trains of thought. One is like, where do I start? Okay, so you can start measuring things, right? You could finger in the wind, like, okay, I run this business. To run this, I need this. And to see the benefit of running this business, I need to take this out of it. And I think when you start seeing a service as more material than we're maybe accustomed to thinking about it, again, it goes back to kind of those input and outputs. And one train of thought of where to start is identify where in that process of mapping those inputs and outputs you can measure something. Because if you can measure something, you can understand it and you can work to reduce it. And when I said measure something, that could be the carbon emissions of whatever you need to use to get stuff to your shop. Whether that be fly it from elsewhere or you source it locally and it's delivered by bike. Or it could be energy usage, right? And I think I really see the benefit in measurement because it gives you a baseline from which you can see, okay, well, if I change that, oh, funnily enough, like my bills have gone down and I'm reducing electricity. Like that's interesting. But measurement can be really hard and really abstract. And that's not necessarily always where I suggest people to start. But I think where I suggest people to start is that further upstream of what I mentioned of like, well, have you thought about your business or your service as materials, like as something that you can grasp? And I think, you know, there's books to be read and I think one for me around where to start is, I think it becomes a little bit more personal. And this is where the individual in the service, in the system, that whole is, you know, if you want to start thinking about adaptation, it's like, well, what is important to you? What do you care about? What do you want to see survive? And I think it's got to come from some emotional place because it's too hard to pursue otherwise. You know, like it's very hard to convince senior stakeholders to invest in this, or it's still, there's a lot of ESG, you know, environmental sustainability reporting and that, but it bogged down, I think, in a lot of bureaucracy. It's very hard to do. It can be quite expensive. But, you know, we talk a little bit about how to maintain personal resilience in the training at the end. And I also think that's probably where you need to start is, like, I think making climate change relevant to your operations. So understanding what it is and where it's come from, you know, extraction, colonization, like, and then thinking, using that knowledge to empower yourself to think about, well, what is important to you, what is worth making changes for, So I, there's an element of humanizing the measurement and the science. And I think when people grasp what is at stake, then applying that and starting that in your work becomes a little bit easier. And of course, then there are so many tools now to help with carbon measurement. And there are lots of courses out there for people to kind of educate themselves around what this means to businesses. I wouldn't be surprised if every business is probably having to do some form of, if they're tending for a bid or some sort of climate. You know, we're starting to see legal requirements, I think, catch up with business operations. And all of that is an exercise of bringing something that is quite abstract to. And I think it would be in any service owner's or business manager's best interest to see these patterns emerging and understand what it means to you. And I would reach out to people. I think where I normally start is like reaching out to people and saying, like, I run this and I don't really know where to start with it if I'm trying to reduce my carbon emissions. There are business groups focused on this now. Like, it's not a case of people facing this alone anymore. And that would probably be long story. That was a long thread. That would probably where it starts, is like find your community that is also trying to figure out where to start, because they exist everywhere in every sector. And I think anyone would quickly find, you know, there's probably a small businesses for climate in their region, or, and then all of a sudden you're not alone and it doesn't feel so. So that would be my, I found it, that would be my where to start. And then I think it's just a case of figuring out what that means for your context and your financial position and the skills and capabilities you have to navigate that, you know?
I like this approach where you say there is already someone who has gone through that path. Just find them and ask them, what did you do in my context, which is specific in my country, my legal system? And, oh, these are the people to talk to. These are the resources that can help in that language that I can understand.
It is, unfortunately. I think we all want a blanket solution, right? If only it was that easy. I think, unfortunately, it is very context specific. Your laws in Switzerland are different from mine in England, which are different from mine in Scotland. Our goals around, our targets around reduction are different. So, but yeah, I think we have to take comfort in community at this juncture, because or else it just feels way too hard. And it's scary, you know, like it's not, you don't pick up a paper and read it around climate change and put it down feeling optimistic or like, it goes back to what we were discussing before. And there's a slide in my training, which is like, unfortunately, we have to talk about risk at the moment because it's a way to wake people up. It's like, boom, here's the bottom line if you don't do this. But hope is what has to sustain us. Like, we cannot address this on risk alone. We have to imagine that a world that we could create and addressing it now is going to be more just and fair. And we're not going to leave people behind. Like, this is a growing interest at the intersection of accessibility within service design and climate adaptation. What we don't want to perpetuate is, you know, the rich being able to adapt at the expense of poor, disabled people who won't be able to escape if the building floods. And I'm really interested. I haven't managed to sink my teeth into that type of work yet, but I think that's, you know, very interesting. So, yeah, I think, I don't know where I was going with that thought, but it kind of, the risk and the hope stuff. And the hope also, you can sustain that a lot longer if you do it in community rather than on your own. And I think in any government department, or now in government, in central government in the UK, you know, there's a whole sustainability community. So there's people working in digital services that are like, oh God, you know, this is my job. And I like want to feel like I'm doing something within my job that helps this. It might be little, but there's communities there. And then in local government, they'll be different. So they are there. And if they're not there, then you can start one.
There's this very beautiful thing that you said of adaptation shouldn't leave people behind. I think there is something quite strong for our generation, which has lived COVID and has seen how adaptation was quite fast for the digitally savvy, etc. It was very easy. And then you suddenly looked at other groups of people and you said, oh shit, for them, it's like they completely lost relationships. They completely lost contact and so on. And I'm wondering, when it comes to making thinking about adaptations that don't leave people behind, what are ways of thinking, tips that you have to make sure that we don't leave people behind? Because we might say, I'm a dentist, I think about the heat waves. Okay, we could do these and these things in our service that makes it possible to continue our service. But how can this dentist or this coach or whatever think about, but if I adapt in that way, maybe
I think it's a big mindset shift. I mean, I think in any of those professions, irregardless of climate change, people, I would hope that people would want to serve people that need it. If somebody can't afford to get their tooth fixed, like, I would like to imagine that most dentists would try and find ways to. And I think this is really important, where we don't separate. Climate isn't, it's not, it doesn't need to be separate. And I think actually it goes back to the principles of co-design, participatory design. Who is designing these adaptation pathways for us? Like, it cannot be me in a little design studio being commissioned for 3 months. Like, I think this demands a different way of how we involve people in decision-making, whether you're running a dentistry or not. You know, I think a dentist practice could ask the question now of, like, are we serving our most vulnerable, irregardless of whether they're experiencing climate impacts? And I think that's a really important question that we need to interrogate. You know, digital design in the UK, we're pretty good at accessibility, of course. And what I mean is people that need to navigate digital technology with assistive technologies, or they're blind, or. And there's a lot of chat around this and, like, community organizing around having to print posters or whatever in multiple languages, because that is who your community is. And this goes back to the point about resilience. And I think this is kind of why I'm starting to land on resilience as an interesting space, because it builds on community in the way that services, if they're, like, a dentistry is part of a neighborhood, part of a wider community. And I think what this demands is, like, well, what is that role of this dentist? And there's loads of interesting articles about emergency response. And the big saviors are not coming for you. It's your neighbor. Like, so we need to get, it's back to first principles. And this is, I think, why it feels quite hard in an environment of budget stripping. And I don't know if this is the case where you are, but there's very little money in the UK at the moment to run public services. They threaten to cut the personal independence payment, which is quite a big disability payment afforded to people who struggle into work. And this, to me, is like a climate. This is a climate justice issue. And I think where a lot of climate stuff has failed is in just being like, the birds and the bees, which, don't get me wrong, is really important and needs a voice in the room as much as, but it also comes at the expense of people. And so going back to the dentist, I don't think dentists are being asked, well, what's your role in the community? They'll be like, we're just here to fix teeth. But actually, they're probably a bit of a community hub. You know, they have they have a distribution list. They have a means of, they have a physical building where people can come and organize, you know, so they actually have a lot of strength potentially if shit hits the fan, there's a huge climactic event, but none of us are prepared to see our dentist as that. And so I think where the interesting work is going on in adaptation and resilience is in that community neighborhood-based work that sees climate adaptation not as a replacement, but an extension of the work that they already do. Unfortunately, I don't think this is what's funded, certainly not here in the UK. And I think that's where we need to inject. You know, there's huge rifts between the left and the right here, you know, pro-immigration, like all of these wider societal issues are creating really big crevices, I think, in our ability to be able to be resilient. And part of me is like, maybe I just need to drop this whole climate thing in the way that I present myself and actually just go back and do youth work or like, you know, start at those principles, right? And stop working on about services. And because it, again, I can only speak from a UK context, like services are being really stripped back here. And I think we have to ask what public services, I should say, you know, and that's not to say that private services are bad or any of that. I think it's just recognizing questions around access and around whether we are actually addressing user needs. So, yeah, you know, I think there's a lot of climate advocates that I follow that, you know, are, and it's something that I'm thinking about increasingly. I don't want to go to more climate events if there isn't a justice angle. Because oftentimes, if I'm being very honest, it's people like me, pretty white, middle class, loves to garden, you know, and the room is full of people like me, eco warriors. I can afford my refill shop. Like, you know, I can afford to choose not to have a car, really. But we're not gonna win any of this if huge parts of my community here in East Sussex are angry at immigrants because they think they're taking their houses. You know, like it's the narrative dissonance is, and I think we have to, there's a responsibility for those services to think about climate, but then I think there's a responsibility for people who think about climate to also relate back. And I think it's a big reorganization, but it's really, and I think that's why the climate work is so hard in this era of austerity, you know, public services in the UK. And I speak a lot about public services because primarily where I work. And I think it's quite a big foundation of service design. And so it's very hard to come from a place of building community resilience when it's so broken anyway. But it goes back to our original question, is that it's inevitable. So what are you going to do about it? So it's I'd like to empower everybody to feel like they have a responsibility for addressing climate adaptation. And I think, you know, I actually think a lot of people know on the ground, the nurses that are having to show up, like the NHS has clauses now. If you cannot come to work because there's a flood or a climatic event, this is what. So there are already, you know, policies in place that help people navigate this. But yeah, I'd love more money to flow into connecting these dots, but it's not what's funded at the moment. What's still funded is digital transformations. But I think, you know, climate activists and climate people and those of us, we have a lot to learn from disability activism and, you know, a lot to learn from people who have always lived on the margins. And I think that goes back to making sure that when we are designing any sort of intervention, we just make sure, like really adamantly, I know there's a lot of talk about co-design and participation, but really dig our heels into that, because I think that's all related.
It's beautiful how this idea of saying, if we serve one side, say planet, let's not forget the other side, the human. If we serve the human, let's not forget the other side. That is, you said that in a quite poetic way. It's nice to tend to the bees and the birds, but if there's someone on the floor who has an issue, has a broken leg or something, maybe we can attend to that person too.
Yeah.
So,
because I think really there's not enough people thinking about the bees and the birds too. And without them, we like forget everything, you know, they really underpin. And that, yeah, that disconnect feels very, very high. But, you know, going back to your dentist practice, they probably exist, that their building in which they operate exists in a spot where maybe they could put a couple nice flowering plants out front. You know, and I think this is doing what we can with what we have. And that doesn't mean you need a agro diverse food forest in your back garden if you're a dentist. It means like you can collect water. You know, you can put water butts on your property and use that to feed the plants that you grow that help pollinators at your entrance. Like, and there's a big movement in the UK at the moment, what people are calling like more than human narratives involved in policy making. And I don't know whether you have the same trend in Switzerland, but it's very, very big to, like, you know, in a decision-making space, bring a representative from the local river into there. And I don't know the impact of what those initiatives have been but it's interesting to see a lot of resource going into that at the moment around PhDs. Someone for you maybe just to check out is the work that Phoebe Tickle is doing with moral imaginations, because she would argue that, you know, the reason why policy and decision making is so stuck is because we fail to imagine otherwise. And I think this imagination work is, it's not the work that I do, but I think it's very important. So I think, yeah, that the challenge is ours to incorporate the justice part with the birds and the bees. Like, that's a lot to weigh up options for. But I think we have to, we just have to figure out how to do it. Because if we neglect one, we'll neglect the other. And then, yeah, what we can't afford to do is just everybody who can afford it retracting into the background while bees are dying and somebody else, you know. So, and that's why I think it is really important for all of us, especially if we work on our computers a lot and in our little cool studios in the setting out, we have got to get out and like dig some holes and test some soil and do community water testing and build an affiliation to your natives. It doesn't need to demand that much, but I think we do need to, especially in the West, we need to recurate our relationships to nature. I just sometimes wonder how much we have to do that individually in our own lives and how much that comes into our work with these explicit like toys that we're designing. So, yeah.
And so if you had a business owner in front of you who says, oh, that sounds interesting, this idea of bringing the let's go back to nature moments into my work, because I imagine it, instead of doing one of those team building events that is nonsensical, we could do something else, which is both purpose driven and at the same time makes people go back from the screen. What are initiatives where you say, oh, these are things that business owners could more easily say to their staff, hey, this is part of work. We each week, each month, we could set some time for such actions. What would your wish list of actions be?
Well, I think one thing is that all of that is predicated on probably defining new business models where we give staff time to do this with intention. And I think I mean the intention part really earnestly, because I think it's very easy to be like, oh yeah, we went on a team day and we, you know, helped a local group and then you never see them again. What is that actually? And that's probably more of something that I would encourage is, you know, adopt a site or figure out a relationship locally and hold that over the longer term, because I think that both helps stretch our capacity for longer term relationship building and also keeps the benefits of what we're trying to do where we operate and where we work, which is where I think the change needs to come from. Governments are not, like, that's not going to be the way that we. And so I think if I'm faced with that business owner, you know, I would probably have conversations about the, like, where they operate and do they operate in different places and who their staff are and what skills do they want to gain. And, oh, there's that men in sheds group over there that can teach your employees how to build that stuff that they. And I'm interested increasingly in like local economies and, you know, how services, like so much wealth gets extracted because of the way that we commission and procure things. And this has been my kind of like thread lately of, you know, how we don't incorporate sustainability into new contracts very well. And therefore, and I think where I'm going with this is that I would first encourage any business to adapt to the place that they operate to be more, you know, can you put a pond in to help wildlife, or can you invite people to your space that maybe wouldn't have access to it? And then, yeah, what, or, and out with that, like what is needed in your immediate local community? Like, oh, interesting. In that field over there, they're wanting to fundraise to build a community orchard. So I think a lot, sometimes I feel like a lot of, especially from maybe a business perspective, depending on the size, there's a lot of looking outwards, right? Like, and all of these initiatives are necessary. Fundraising to save coral in Australia, like, you know, Amazon, like, please don't get me wrong there. Like, we need to invest in that stuff. But I think especially in a country like the UK, I think we're the lowest ranking in terms of green space and tree cover in Europe. So like, I think we've got to do, and I think that's a double-edged sword of actually doing stuff locally, whether it be planting a tree that makes sure it's the right tree in the right place, or adapting our spaces of operation to be more, to capture more water, or, and then using that to build stronger ties with our neighbors and our, so you're adapting and you're building resilience all the while giving your staff a little bit more time to, I mean, that would be the dream. I know there's a lot of chat about 4-day weeks, universal income, and I get it. Like, I think that is a huge systems lever if we could get that moving to help with some of this stuff. But, you know, I know most businesses who try to build ethical governance structures that afford their staff to do this, it's not easy. So we need more examples of that and that working financially for a business. But man, it's hard to run a business at the moment, certainly a small one, which is why they're getting bigger and more dissociated with place. And I think that's our challenge. So again, depends on the business, depends on the, but yeah, I think if we can think about where we're, it goes back to where we're getting our inputs from, what we're doing with them while we're there, which affects what we spew at the other end. So there's a narrative thread in all of this, something.
Thanks so much. If you had to give, let's say it like that, we've covered already a few things, and I will do a not shameless plug, which is there is a very good course that you're part of around more sustainable services. It's from the School of Good Princes.
School of Good Services, led by Lou Down and Sarah Drummond. So Lou wrote the Good Services book, or Good Service Design. Can't remember all the spots. That's not a good plug, is it? It's just, or yeah, Designing Good Services is the name of their book. And yeah, they developed this training of which they kindly asked me and a very dear friend of mine, a very, very deeply knowledgeable person around adaptation and resilience, Ness Wright, who lives up in Glasgow. Like, I want to give out a shout out to Ness because she was pretty instrumental in helping design this course. Yeah, so Ness and I worked in Sarah at Snoke. It's where I started in life, all like services, planet stuff. And yeah, we run the Designing Sustainable Services 1-day training to lead us.
And so there are these resources, which I'm sure many people will want to follow. And there is also a lot of good writing from back in the days when Snoke was not what it is today. It was a bit of a different company from what I could see. But there is still a lot of good Medium articles that you guys wrote around that I found particularly useful. So that's also a very good resource. But outside of those resources, is there something else that you say that you would like to put as a reminder, as a bit of a call to action for people who are either working in the service industry or who are service designers, where you say, when we think about climate justice, climate adaptation, climate everything, think about that. This is a last input that I'd like to give you guys.
I mean, two things pop into my head immediately. I don't know how they pertain particularly to services. But the first one is and it's UK specific, so maybe it's not the best example, but Stop Cambo is the latest advocacy to stop an oil field being developed in the north of England. And I think just being aware of that is very useful because they very well articulate the narrative around, you know, what extraction of oil means and why it's so detrimental. I think from a service perspective, so there's a couple of things that I will point out that I'm playing with at the moment, which is, in the UK, DEFRA has created greener service principles, which are their principles for greening service design. Maybe more candidly, probably not to articulate in the book, I'm a little critical of them. Like, I don't think they're the best principles, but they are there and they are guiding some decision making for how to bring in sustainability into government service design. So needed, I'm not going to fault it. So that's another resource. I think the Design Council in the UK is doing a lot of work around Skills for Planet, where they are trying to identify where in design as a very big discipline are the levers for change to incorporate sustainability and planetary health into what we do. They've got a new book. I think it's called Skills for Planet. It's like a PDF. It's very long. Some of this stuff, I'm like, oh, we're really not helping ourselves here. But there are a lot of resources out there. Obviously, our training. And my advice would be to pick up a tool and try and apply it in context. And very quickly, you will be humbled, because I've tried to apply some of the tools that we develop and offer those that come to our training in the context I'm working now. And seems really hard to just fill out an input output map of a service, but you know, just getting the right people in the room can take months. And I think that's what's really humbled me. I think we are very guilty, especially in service design, of creating lots of tools and frameworks. And I think we're drowning in them a little bit, but what we're not doing is saying we tried it and it didn't really work. And that's no criticism of the tool. And I think this is what we're a little scared of. It's like, if my tool doesn't work, am I legit? But I would look for the case studies of stuff being applied in principle. And for me, that's also meant going, stretching my ideas of beyond service design. So some of my best work lately was work that I did working in a big built environment company. And that was around using the tools of service design to think about community-based flooding infrastructure or develop new stewardship schemes for water management. And I would encourage service designers, if they're working in healthcare, to look out with just the service design discipline, because the way other industries are trying to adjust to this change, I think, can be really insightful. So you can look at like the Suds Plus work that I worked on it when I was at ARIC. And so, that's just me rattling off what comes to my head immediately. I mean, if I think of something else, I will definitely let you know. But I'm interested in seeking out the kind of attempts to try it. And more ways to share our learnings. So I hope that's helpful. I'm not great at thinking all questions.
Yes. No worries. Yeah, and it's to me, it feels like you giving pointers to people, and obviously everyone will have them to look for them, what makes sense in their context and so on. So that's obviously very different in every context, every language. The resources are not the same, but it always helps to have a few pointers, because then you can.
For sure. And then
Google
love
around
to see other
and
people
find say, what's useful.
I'm feeling very trapped in a UK mindset at the moment. And I know other countries are looking at this differently, and other countries are much further ahead in thinking about this than we are in the UK. So I think there's a lot that I would look to gain some learning from other countries and their constraints and their. So yeah, it'd be great to see how your resource list evolves.
And you gave a lot in this short conversation that we have. I think many people will come out of it with, oh, wow, this person really helped me a lot. Like Lucy is really a gem. She shared so many things that I can use that can help me think differently. What can people do for you if they arrive at this moment in the conversation and they say, oh, I'd like to give back in some way or form to Lucy?
That's very nice.
She's been so nice with me. What can listeners do for you?
Well, I'm looking for more work. I'm freelancing at the moment. My existing contract is open. And it'd be great, I think the way to spend, I'd love to meet new people and have chats like this a little bit more openly. And of course, if that leads to amazing projects, working with great people, great. But I think where I'm taking a lot of comfort at the moment, and where the benefit of freelancing is these opportunities to meet new people and challenge that. So, you've asked me what people can do for me. I guess it's to get in touch. Like, I'd love to. This is a learning journey. I feel so lucky that my job is also, it feeds me because it keeps me learning, and a way to learn from that is also to speak with others. And I guess that invitation is extended far beyond people who may do service design, or I guess anyone who's found this conversation, you know, like, I'd love to understand what it means in people's context. So yeah, I guess what people could do for me is just like reach out and say hello, because honestly, everything that you said in terms of following my work, and especially when you're freelancing, it can feel quite lonely. And, you know, I talk about all this like building community and da 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 da, but it feels harder to do that in the current working structure that I am. So if anything comes from this where I meet a couple new people, and then that would be amazing.
It's been really a pleasure to finally get to hear the voice behind the good words. So a big thank you to you for taking the time.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for the opportunity. It's been a really lovely way to start the day. I can't thank you enough. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Thanks to you, and enjoy the rest of your summer.
Thank you very much. You too. I will see you soon.
See you.